So if I can welcome you all, first of all, and then Mike Mace from LSC. So to welcome you all, and I wanted to briefly introduce Ross Dunn, who's our speaker this evening, and is the Chief Executive of the Thames Gateway London Partnership. And this evening is going to talk, address the question of the Thames Gateway, still needed, but still a government priority. Big question mark there. So Ross comes to us with admirable credentials, as I'm saying, from a very impressive series of public institutions, so from Her Majesty's Treasury through to the London Development Agency, CLG, involved in the establishment of the Homes and Communities Agency, and then now working as the Chief Executive of the Thames Gateway London Partnership. And to, obviously Ros can give you more of a CV as she wishes, but I guess the single theme there is one of regional economic development, so I'm concerned with regional development with that economic perspective. And this evening, in particular, as I did steal from one of Ros's slides, is the sort of looking at Thames Gateway with a big picture view, so as a project that is 30 years into a 70-year lifespan, and with that sort of a long view, no more ado from me, and to hand over to Ross.
Thank you. Alan, thank you very much. His introduction about me has been very kind, because what you didn't mention, because I didn't tell you, was that an awful lot of my time spent in the Treasury was doing something that most people regard as about the most boring project that was ever done, which was the introduction of accruals-based commercial accounting for government departments. Now, some of you might say, what's that? Some of you might say, my God, I didn't even know they didn't do it. But they didn't, and they do now. And that will probably go down in history as one of the most boring but important things that I've ever done, certainly. Thank you very much for coming today. The topic I've chosen is the Thames Gateway still needed, and you can tell I'm going to say, of course, but still a government priority, and you can tell I'm probably going to say, not so sure. So, in terms of what I want to cover, I want to start with a bit of history, just about how we got to where we are. Then, what I'm going to call some lessons from history. What has all this taught us about how we do things? And then, moving on from that, well, what about the Thames Gateway today? Where are we today? And where are we going to be tomorrow? By which I mean in the immediately foreseeable future. So I hope that's okay. Just in case you don't know what or where the Thames Gateway is, I don't know if you've got a pointer, but I hope you can see all those lines, even at the back. It's this red line that is actually the area, the geographical area known as the Thames Gateway. For comparison, the yellow line is the London boundary, and the blue line is the M25, so it gives you a sense of location and scale. And the Thames Gateway is about 40 miles long, and at its widest part, about 25 miles wide. It comes in three regions, London, Kent and Essex. It has 19 local authorities in its boundary, and when it first started, it was called the largest regeneration project in Western Europe. Now, I'm going to stop there and say, how many people here knew that already? Right, I see it's the front end of the room. Fine. Just in a bit more detail, this is meant to, I'm sorry about the slide quality, but this is meant to just give you the outline and the names of the places which are the actual parts of the Thames Gateway. And I'm sorry it's not very clear, but that's Southend, that's Basildon, that's Swale, that's Medway, Dartford, again, places which I hope you've heard of. But you get the sense of the geography. It's basically the Thames estuary. Just worth mentioning, when I talk about the Thames Gateway and the Thames Gateway London Partnership, our geographical boundary isn't that. Our geographical boundary, which we were which we sort of conveniently allied between the two, is essentially the boroughs in the London sub-region, which is East London, both north and south of the river. So sometimes when I talk about London Thames Gateway, I'm actually referring to a slightly wider area. It's an interesting question as to whether or not you still want to draw the boundary that was drawn when that was drawn, but we'll perhaps move on to that. Some history. I'm not going to go read that in detail because you'll be able to pick up the slides. I think the bit that I wanted to mention is, in a sense, a story that is quite well known to people in the sort of policy development world, which is that one of the things that probably really got this going was Michael Heseltine, who, when he was the Defence Secretary, which he did in between being the City Challenge person and then going on to be the Environment Secretary, he was actually flying along the Thames estuary, the picture that I had right at the front, and thinking, gosh, there's an awful lot of land here, and gosh, it's right next to the city, and it looks pretty awful. Why aren't we doing something about it? So in a sense, there are a lot of people who would say that was the point at which the idea of the Thames Gateway was born, and in those days it was called the East Thames Corridor. That, you'll notice, sort of coincided with about the time of the creation of the London Docklands Development Corporation, all of which was some considerable time after it could be argued it was first identified that it was needed. And the aspiration in those early days was always very much talked about in terms of jobs and homes and development and regeneration and accommodating London's expansion. But things happened during that, and I've started to talk about the new transport links like the DLR and the Jubilee Line extension were a catalyst for change that partly came out of the creation of the London Docklands Development Corporation. Moving on, a bit more history. I mean, you could write a book about this, and many people have written many books, so I'm really only trying to pull out the highlights. Perhaps other people in this room have written a book about it. The focus moved on from the Docklands and the London Docklands Development Corporation to the wider Thames Gateway. And as I say, a lot of that was because people saw the potential that you could do very concentrated things at the western end, but there was actually scope to do a lot more. So the government, and I've got some timelines which I'll show you in a minute, recognised that it needed to do more than just look at the western end of the gateway. And again, a lot of that was thanks to Michael Heseltine, who was around when the Channel Tunnel rail link was first put in place. And Michael Heseltine himself says at great length, for anybody who cares to listen, it was his decision to get CTRL stopping at Ebbsfleet and Stratford, which was one of the things that had a big impact in terms of focusing people's attention towards the eastern end and rectifying what he saw as a real gap in terms of transport infrastructure. And he always says that was him, and he wants to do more now. I have said here, regeneration was further boosted following the successful bid for the Games. I contend that if there hadn't been a Thames Gateway programme, and I hope some of this will explain that, we would never have made a successful bid for the Olympic Games, because we would not have had the transport infrastructure in place that was needed to make that a credible bid. And I'm then really jogging on, and this is, because I say this is just the headlines, I've picked out Terry Fowle, who's a leading British architect, and did an awful lot of work, absolutely thankless task, I may add, trying to convince the government at various points when it looked as if their eye had been taken off the ball, that it was still important and that we still should be concerned about it. So I will return to the question of Terry Farrell's vision for the Thames Gateway based on sustainable growth. Because as I say, this is the headlines. There is a sort of an official story about how this development of the Thames Gateway has been continuous and improving. Whether or not all of us would see it like that is not necessarily the same. And that's where I've got the timeline of developments. And this is, I have to say, a slightly partial view. Any view that you've only got 40 whatever minutes is going to be a very partial view. But I'm saying here, it started with the establishment of the London Docklands Development Corporation. that was when the East Thames Corridor concept became more expressed. It then got translated into the planning framework, and those diagrams I showed you right at the beginning, the maps, that red line was actually given a status of supplementary planning guidance in 1995 as the RPG 9A. The other thing that I haven't mentioned here, and again, you know, you could just go on forever here, is that what happened was all of this, you'll recognise, was done under a Conservative administration. There was a change of government, and actually the government at that time was very keen to say they had an equal understanding of the importance of the Thames Gateway, and they were going to carry it on. Now, there was a very interesting early phase of this, which was that the Prime Minister of the day, Tony Blair, said, we must have a cabinet committee to oversee the delivery and the development of the Thames Gateway. And it was called MISC 22, because all the cabinet subcommittees were called MISC something or other in those days with the number. And I think it would be fair to say, and I'll look to the people at the front of the room to see if that's right, that slightly sank without trace, in that it met, and it met, and then the distance between the meetings got longer and longer, and then it stopped meeting. But at the same time, to be fair, John Prescott, who was at, DETR, as it was then called, did take a genuine and direct interest in the Thames Gateway, much in the same way as Heseltine had done, and so this thing did keep alive, and it did get some legs. That's something to come back to, the establishment of the GLA and the elected Mayor of London and how that impacted on the way all this was done. But I think this Thames Gateway Strategic Partnership, this Sustainable Communities Plan, were very much the way in which a bit more life was breathed back into this policy through, I think I would say, the sort of interventions and impact of John Prescott. And it was, I mean, again, I'm not going to go through this in detail. The London Plan identified the Thames, London Thames Gate was a priority area, and then we'll come on to talk about this in a bit more detail. So that's, in a sense, the development, how we would tell the story. And you can see that we tell it as if it was a really continuous, seamless development of idea and continuation of emphasis. As somebody who was involved in the Thames Gateway, certainly in these later stages, that isn't always how it's felt, and it has sometimes felt that we've had to push and push and push to keep it going. Very big, ambitious targets were set for the Thames Gateway, and they've moved around a bit, but in the Sustainable Communities Plan, to give you a sense of the scale, the government at the time made a commitment that there would be 300,000 jobs delivered in the Thames Gateway by 2031, because this was going to be where London's potential expansion would happen, and it would support the regeneration of the rest of the estuary as well. There are also very ambitious targets for homes to be built. These are all, they're slightly confused because they're on different timescales. There was a commitment to build 110,000 homes by 2016. And of those, 50,000 of them were going to be in the London end of the gateway. So while all that was happening, the history is it's been around for a long time. People have had quite big ambitions for it. Various things have been done along the way to keep it going. So even if none of you, except the people at the front, have ever heard about the Thames Gateway before, it has been around quite a long time, and it has been sort of kept animated by various government initiatives. Much more importantly, however, is it being animated by the fact that things happened there. You know, you can have as many policy initiatives as you want and as many government statements as you want, but if you don't see anything happening, then you think, well, what's all that about? This is, again, a very quick run-through, and I've got some pictures. We'll get on to some pictures in a minute. Designation as an enterprise zone, a very relevant topic, if I may say, which we'll come on to discuss. DLR opened in 1987, City Airport opened, One Canada Square, the big Canary Wharf tower, Jubilee Line extension up to Canary Wharf and Stratford, you get all that. But basically, that story is the one that's the real reason that it kept alive, because things kept happening. A lot of those were done by the Development Corporation. A lot of those were done by government support and sponsorship, and a lot of them were done with a very big and heavy influence from the private sector as well. And I just want to quote to you what the London Docklands Development Corporation claims it achieved during its life. And when I say it claimed, I mean it did do it. This was part of their report. To get a sense of what you can do. They claimed that they'd spent £1.88 billion public sector investment, and they'd levered in £7.7 billion from private sector sources. They'd sold for redevelopment over 1,000 acres of land. They oversaw the development of 144 kilometres of new and improved roads. They oversaw the Docklands Light Railway. They constructed 25 million square feet of commercial and industrial floor space. They built 24,000 new homes. By the end of their time there, they had 2,700 businesses trading, 5 new health centres, with further 6 in development, funding of 11 primary schools, 2 secondary schools, 3 post-16 colleges, and 9 vocational training centres. And by the time they finished, there were 85,000 people employed in the Docklands, where the previous figure had been nil. So the story of the London Docklands Development Corporation is a very, very good one in terms of, here's an area, here's a massive focus of effort. If you put a lot of money in, that's what you can achieve. I'm going to go through these quite quickly, because I think actually the real story is about where we are now, what we do next. And this is, we do this quite a lot in my organisation. We go around to everybody going, oh, how wonderful the Thames Gateway is. And we put up these pictures that I hope people will recognise. Whenever I go on the Docklands Light Railway, which I do every day because I have to do that to go to work, I always feel as if I'm like on an outing, because it's not like the Underground. The Underground feels very sort of London, but the Docklands Light Railway feels like it's in a completely different place. So these are the things that have happened, the DLR and extension to Lewisham and Woolwich. How many people here have been to Woolwich? How many people have been to Lewisham? Okay. One of the things that I find very, very interesting doing my job, which I often have to smile politely through gritted teeth, is when people say, oh yes, they're in Lewisham. They say, yes, I'm going into London actually now. Or they're in Woolwich. I'm going into London. You say, you are in London actually. You don't seem to sort of, you know, there's a real sense that people don't get the geography. Extension of the Jubilee line to Stratford. I mean, Stratford is a whole other story, which I'm sure we'll come on to. But again, that's one of the successes of deliberate government policy and intervention and support. City Airport, East London Line, Stratford International and High Speed 2. One of our less good successes, I think, was managing to build High Speed 1, which connects us to Europe, and I travel on it quite a bit, and maybe others of you do as well, having it go through Stratford International Station, but it doesn't stop there. And there are people who think there's something rather odd about having a station in Newham called Stratford International that does not have any international trains stopping there. And then Crossrail is coming, and again, Crossrail is essential for the London economy, and I'm sure you'll be told that in all sorts of places. It's absolutely essential for the Thames Gateway, and for the London Thames Gateway to deliver what London wants of it and needs of it. Canary Wharf, that's just a great iconic picture. I find it very interesting that whenever they're talking about terrible financial news on the news, they always put the picture of Canary Wharf up, which Canary Wharf get really a bit fed up about, but anyway. And that is being expanded. There's further development in another little bit that you can't see, on the Isle of Dogs, which is called Wood Wharf, and when that is all built out and completed, there will be 180,000 people working on the Canary Wharf estate. And I don't have the figures with me, but there's a very interesting timeline as to the which correlates the number of jobs and the access to transport. And the people at Canary Wharf tell the good story, maybe not such a good story, about how they, because the Jubilee line was delayed, their ability to expand was delayed. So that's another of our great successes. I'm going to go through a bit more quickly because I want to get on to the future. Greenwich Peninsula, the chair of my partnership is somebody called Charlie Faulkner, who used to be the Lord Chancellor, but was also responsible for the selling off of the Millennium Dome. There is an interesting story about all that, but it's undoubtedly the case that given that the O2 is now the biggest entertainment venue, in fact in the world, not in Europe, it is now, that is a major success, and the whole of the Greenwich Peninsula is now being developed with new facilities, and we're also London's first cable car is going to go from Greenwich Peninsula over to the Royal Docks in Newham. So those are successes. What can we learn from the past? I said at the outset I was going to do some lessons from history. I've thought about this, and I'm sure others have, and I think the things that made that work, what I've just been outlining, could be put into two categories. One is Heseltine, Prescott, and Ken Boris, and the other is the money and the control. And I think what history has shown, I think has shown me, is that the times when the Thames Gateway has really motored forward has been when there's been very, very strong, active, and powerful, important point, powerful leadership, either from within central government or following devolution and the creation of the Greater London Authority from a strong and strongly committed mayor. That has been, again, you can do the time charts and all the periods when the Thames Gateway has pushed forward has been when those people have been intervening. They've also had an awful lot of money to spend. I did some calculations and I calculated that the LDDC had something in today's prices in the order of £4.5 billion to spend. And even the Thames Gateway Growth Fund, which the government had, is about £600 million. Now, if you've got that amount of money to spend, it's not really surprising. You can do quite a lot of stuff. That's just the public money. That's before we talk about the private money that's levered in. And the other point is the point about control. And as I say, I'm going to say a little bit more about that in a moment, but the London Docklands Development Corporation, as covering an enterprise zone, they could do a lot of things that it isn't possible to do without the controls, the relaxations in planning controls that they had, the fiscal stimulus measures that they were able to use. So money in control and big names with a big amount of power and push are, I think, the things that correlate with the times when the Thames Gateway moved forward in this not very seamless world. Yes, but winning formula for big ticket items. I said, oh, the DLR is wonderful, City Airport is wonderful, Jubilee Line Extension is wonderful. But was it so good for the social and economic regeneration which benefits our residents? And I want to come, that's an important question, and I want to come back to that. And anyway, it doesn't even matter if we thought it was great, we're not going to get it. The coalition government believes in localism and not top-down central control. We might come back to exactly how that shows itself, but anyway. That world, we're not in that world anymore. We're in a world where we are going to do a lot more bottom-up. And also, money is scarce. So we have to recognise that whatever happens moving forward, we've got to find ways of pushing things forward in a slightly different way from the way that it might have been pushed forward in the past. Challenges remain. I just thought it was nice to have some pictures. That's Brick Lane, and I'm not sure where the
estate is. I think it's the Gascoigne estate in Bock. Just a picture, just to break the flow up more.
And when I say, has it done as much for our residents? Here are some statistics that I think it's quite important not to lose sight of. We still have big challenges in the London Thames Gateway in particular, more so than in Kent and Essex, where our residents do not do as well as residents in the other parts of the capital and in a lot of the rest of the country. So here, what I'm saying is, you can see the line, it's gone down, it's starting to peak up again in terms of unemployment, but workforce participation is the lowest rate in inner East London for the whole of London. Employment remains, but in low-skilled sectors, for local residents. I'm not saying, we know a lot of high-value-added jobs in Tower Hamlets, but they tend not to be filled by local residents. So that's the unemployment picture very quickly now. Skills, if you look at the London East average on that, we are considerably below the Britain average, and we are lower than anywhere else in London, and we're also lower than Essex and Kent, so we're the lowest in the Gateway. That's the skills story. And then on deprivation, again, these are, you know, a lot of people at the front end of this room know these statistics. It doesn't matter what we do, if you look at what's happened to the residents, which is how this is measured, they have not benefited. This is Canary Wharf. So Canary Wharf, I can't remember what the number is in terms of its contribution to UK GDP, but it's jolly well not helping the people who live there. And that's where you have to say, the previous model of, oh, it was all great top-down, slap on an enterprise zone, throw a lot of money at it and look what you can do. All of that has not addressed those problems. And that's why when I ask the exam question, is it still needed? I want to say that it's partly for data like this that tells you it's still needed. Public sector dependence, I've put that because it's actually quite important to the current debate. What this is telling you, and again I'm afraid it's not a particularly easy slide to read, is that for a number of the local authorities in the London East sub-region, they have a much higher level of dependency on public sector jobs than many parts of the rest of the country. There's the London average in terms of the people who are in the public sector, and then look at some of ours, we've got much, much higher dependence. So, and that's important when I come to say a little bit about the regional growth fund and enterprise zones and things like that, which are the current government's view about instruments of policy that should be implemented now. High levels of public sector dependence. So my summary is that I think the Thames Gateway has been transformed over the last 30 years. And I think we should be proud of that. Collectively, the policy community should probably be quite proud of the fact that we managed to keep that going. But, big but, the regeneration of the Thames Gateway, and I'm using a definition here that the government has used. I'd slightly like to admit that they used it because when I was in CLG and working on this, we came up with that. But I haven't heard anybody describe it better. The regeneration of the Thames Gateway still has a long way to go. So we've put in a lot of good kit, and I haven't even talked about all the stuff that's coming from the Olympics, but we haven't yet cracked some of the underlying problems that remain in that area. And again, I just thought it'd be nice to have a picture. They look much nicer on my screen than they seem to there, but I see that out of my window every day because I work in East India Dock. That will be obvious, and I hope they will. And that's just to show that there's a lot of young people learning there. What's next for anybody who's watched the West Wing? The Conservative Liberal Democrat coalition government supports the Thames Gateway. And fair's fair. It's usually the people in the back who make a noise, you know. Fair's fair. We are the only area in the country to have a Thames Gateway minister, and that's not very well worded, obviously. We are the only, we are the only area in the country to have a minister who has in their title responsibility for an area. However, where we used to talk about the giants like Heseltine, Michael Heseltine and John Prescott, Bob Neil is he's a very, very nice man. He's deeply committed to the Thames Gateway. He is a parliamentary Undersecretary of State, which is, I think, the first rung on the ministerial ladder, would be a way to put it. He was previously, though, to be fair, he was a member of the GLA. He was GLA Assembly Member for Havering, which is in the Thames Gateway. So he does come to this with a lot of knowledge and a lot of passion and a lot of commitment, but he is a parliamentary Under-Secretary of State, so he doesn't come with the authority that we've seen in the past. And I would contend we don't necessarily need the same model that we had in the past, but we do need the same strength and drive. We just need it to be done in a different way. But we do have that. Consistently with the government's approach to localism and foreshadowed in the growth white paper, we've just set up a new Thames Gateway strategic group, locally led with the minister in attendance. And it had its first meeting a couple of weeks ago. So I've just realised I haven't got to sit with my slides. Sorry, just bear with me. That's because I got carried away, so I'm really sorry about that. Right. Government's approach to localism, new Thames Gateway strategic group, locally led with the minister in attendance, and also jogging back to something I said earlier about the Farrell core vision, which I'm going to quote from in a second, the government has said in terms that they support that. A couple of points though. Firstly, localism doesn't necessarily mean what you might think it means, because the most recent addition to the long list of local enterprise partnerships is the London Enterprise Partnership, which has as one of its sort of great strengths that it is a functional economic area, which is one of the definitions of what a local enterprise partnership should be, that accounts for 25% of the English economy. So when I think of local, I don't necessarily think of something that accounts for 25% of the English economy. We were trying to get a sub-regional local enterprise partnership, and we are now working with the London Enterprise Partnership to see how we will work together. On the Farrell vision, I did just want to quote for it, because what I was telling you about before, about what the government was trying to do, was all about housing and jobs. And it was really all about housing and jobs, and that there were issues about that. What the Farrell vision says, however, and I'm not exactly quoting from it, and this is, we're 30 years into a regeneration project, what are the next 40 years going to be like? Because Terry Farrell thinks we are 30 years into a 70-year regeneration project and we've got another 40 years to go. And those 40 years that are coming up aren't necessarily going to look like the 30 years that we've had, because his concept is slightly different. He thinks, quote, "The end game is for the Thames Gateway's success to support London's world city status and the Greater South East's global competitiveness through sustainable economic growth in a range of sectors," well, that's sort of the same, "an innovative low-carbon economy," they weren't talking about that 30 years ago, "major growth in employment and housing," yes, that was always on the agenda, but that tended to be the thing that was on the agenda, "inclusive growth based on increased skills levels," that's beginning to address some of the things that my slides, I think, were telling us we haven't done quite right yet, "higher quality of life, attracting inward investment and new residents, and being a major source of revenue for government." So it's a slightly different prospectus and a slightly different agenda in terms of where we go next. Now, as I say, they support the Thames Gateway, and the machine isn't working. We're really behind the Thames Gateway, but the government is seeking to achieve a relative regional effect. Now, you know, I'm sure that you people will probably be able to understand that better than me. But what it involves is rebalancing the economy through supporting the rest of the country, excluding the greater southeast. In other words, the Thames Gateway. So, yeah, they really like the Thames Gateway, but their policy is to achieve a relative regional effect. And I'll give you another quote. Right. Debating the national insurance holiday, my organisation launched quite a fierce campaign when the government proposed a national insurance holiday that meant employers in every part of the country outside the greater southeast could employ their first 10 employees with a reduction in the amount they had to pay in national insurance contributions. We thought this was unfair. We kept quoting the fact that, I should add, that this measure was designed to be targeted towards areas that had high public sector job dependency, which is why I put that slide up earlier. So the government is out there saying, we think it's really important to have a measure to stimulate enterprise growth in areas that have high public sector job dependency and that are going to suffer because of the downturn in the public sector. So that's why we're having this measure. So we said, well, if that's why you're having this measure, why can't you apply it to us? In Newham, the public sector job dependency stands at 33%, and we are not entitled to have this measure applied to us. Whereas in Macclesfield, which is, the public sector job dependency is 11%. So we said, it's not fair. We were quite successful at getting an awful lot of members of Parliament when it was going through the Commons, and then members of the House of Lords when it was going through the Lords, challenging the government on this and saying, you should do it differently. You should do it by reference to levels of deprivation, which is a pretty standard way of looking at these things. And this is what Lord Sassoon said. Now, I have to say, I struggled with this. This measure does need to be targeted, but it can't be targeted in a way which picks out pockets of deprivation. However, the basis of, this is a direct quote, right? The basis on which we came up with the holiday includes a relative regional effect. Of course, if we were to sweep away all the geographic exclusions, the thrust of the holiday, which will be to have a relative regional effect, would disappear, right? I'm only quoting. But our view, you can see where this is going, was to say, if you think the Thames Gateway is still a priority, why are you taking measures that would be exactly the sort of measures that we could claim applied to our sub-region, and saying they won't be applied to us because, of course, the thrust of the holiday, which will be to have a relative regional effect, will disappear? I'd be grateful if somebody who understands that more clearly than I do can explain it to me. Right, I'm going to get some up there. Enterprise zones. I have been singing the praises of the wonders of the London Docklands Development Corporation and how incredibly successful it was in stimulating the growth of the western end of the Thames Gateway and the Isle of Dogs. Didn't do everything it was meant to do, but certainly fantastic success story. And in fact, when we had our first meeting of the Thames Gateway Strategic Group, it took place in Canary Wharf because it was me who organised it. And I mainly organised it in Canary Wharf because we decided we were going to call for an economic zone, enterprise zone for the Thames Gateway. And we thought, if we do this in Canary Wharf, we can say, which we did, well, it took an enterprise zone to get this going 20 years ago today when Canary Wharf Tower opened, 30 years ago when the LDDC was set up. If that's what it took 30 years ago, now is the time to reinvigorate this policy that you support by letting us be an economic or an enterprise zone, right? And we press released it, pictures in Canary Wharf, all the rest of it. And then I don't know what the budget is going to say precisely, but what they're already trailing is, oh yes, there are going to be enterprise zones, but they're going to be established in areas of England that have been hit hard by the economic downturn, mainly in parts of the Midlands and the North. And all the rest of it is, you know, sort of, let's wait and see what they say. But yet again, we're saying, you say that this is a priority, but some of your policies that we would really think appropriate to apply to the Thames Gateway, A, because it's justified, and B, because you say it's a priority, you're almost certainly not going to do. Unintended consequences, those two that I've just described, like the National Insurance Holiday and the enterprise zones, sound like a deliberate policy that is deliberately being designed not to benefit the Thames Gateway. I know you all had a talk about housing not long ago, so I'm not going to go into that in great detail, but I think one of the unintended consequences of policy reform, which again has a potentially adverse impact on our sub-region, on our part of the Thames Gateway, is the whole sort of nexus of policy reforms in the areas of welfare, housing benefit, other out-of-work benefits and in-work benefits. And what this is saying here is that when the housing benefit reforms kick in, an awful lot of the centre of London and the west of London will become unaffordable, and actually, if people want to remain in London, that's likely to drive them into East London. And the difficulties with that are that the people that are driven into East London for those reasons are quite likely to be the people either who are already not in work, and therefore you're adding to your stock of unemployment, or they might have been in relatively low-paid jobs qualifying for benefit, but because of the move, they won't be able to carry on with their jobs because they won't be able to afford to travel. So we see this as a potentially very big and worrying development. When Boris Johnson talks about Kosovo-style ethnic cleansing, what he means is it's all coming to us, basically. That's a bit of an exaggeration. It's not all coming to us. You might have seen this chart before because it was produced by a shelter. Those bits in green are the bits of the capital that, on various calculations, will remain affordable. And as you can see, if you're living there, or even there, that's where you might want to go, or a disproportionate number of people want to go there. Now, I'm going to go quite quickly because I want to leave time for a conversation. To sort of sum all that up, I started by saying we've done a load of stuff, it's been really good. Made a lot of things happen in the Thames Gateway. But we haven't done everything, there are still social needs that need to be addressed. I then went on to say, and does the government like this or not? Well, the government says it's a priority, but seems to follow a lot of policies either directly affecting us adversely or indirectly affecting us adversely. So I conclude that our case should be heard. We said we wanted an economic zone. We think we still need support. That's the Newham versus Macclesfield. And we think we're vulnerable to the impact of other policy reforms. And I just want to move very quickly onto the very last bit. Some of it's about tackling need, but it's also about capitalising on opportunity. I don't want to tell the story that, oh, it's all so awful that the government's got to do things, because actually, you know, there's sort of, all it is about tackling need. There's also a lot going on that can be built upon. And then I would say that remember that the Thames Gateway was a growth area and the rest of the country needs it to work. So very quickly, the case for the London Thames Gateway, the knowledge economy, home to 8 leading universities, I know who they are, even if other people know the time. Specialist facilities in key fields, broadcasting at Ravensbourne. If anybody hasn't been to Ravensbourne College, which is the centre of excellence for broadcast media, it's a really, really good building. And there are other parts of the Gateway that are starting to specialise in this. And then Tech City, Who heard the Prime Minister announce Tech City, the new Silicon Corridor, Silicon Roundabout? That man over there. A lot of this is saying the knowledge economy is one of our potential unique selling propositions, and that that's something where you'd say it isn't just about dealing with disadvantage, it's also about recognising opportunity. The Olympics and the Paralympics, if we can't make something of the fact that very large amounts of public sector money and certain amounts of private sector money has gone into East London, the five Olympic host boroughs, if we can't capitalise on that, frankly, we should all be out of business. So again, I think this is well understood, and I haven't mentioned convergence. I think this is well understood, but again, it's saying government, you can't forget this sub-region, because it is the biggest regeneration development, and again, it's an amazing site for anybody who gets the opportunity to look. Finally, our location and links. What's really striking, and this I think goes a bit back to the big kit, is that part of the opportunity is that East London is getting much, much better connected than it was before, and it has land, and some of that land is quite cheap. So it is bound to be something that investors will want to take an interest in. So this is the thing we want to keep talking about. We're also quite young, and I'm not speaking personally here, but in East London, they're quite young. We have a much lower than average, London is a young city anyway. East London is the youngest part of the capital. And again, what's the future? It's the people sitting in the back there. It's, you know, you're all going to keep us in our old age, we hope. So you really do have to say, if there's large numbers of young people, that's an opportunity. Very quickly, and they're all very entrepreneurial, that's what that says. Business formation rate is really high. The companion slide, which I sometimes put up but I haven't put up here, is actually the survival rate is not that great. But again, it's entrepreneurial spirit and adventure is all there. The digital economy, which I mentioned before, again, we've got quite high levels of people working in knowledge sectors, and it's something that we want to capitalise on. To sum up again, you'd be glad to know this is actually the end. Temsco is 30 years into a 70-year regeneration project. Now is not the time to assume it's all okay. If the government, through whatever routes, takes its foot off the pedal, things won't happen. This is quite important. When I said, I do like Bob Neil, but he's not a Michael Heseltine, I don't mean somebody's got to go around telling everybody what to do. But what we do need is somebody in government who can be an incredibly strong and powerful champion. And you need probably somebody with a bit more status than Bob, though he's a very nice and supportive minister. That's, I think, my last point. Support us in deeds as well as words. And again, to sum up, my exam question was, is it a priority for the government? My conclusion is the government says it is. A lot of what the government is doing isn't consistent with that. And if I could say one thing to a government minister if they were in the room now, I'd say, if you really mean it when you say that the Thames Gateway remains an important priority, which I believe you should, can you please make sure that what government does across the piece is consistent with that and doesn't actually work sometimes in potentially the opposite direction? And that's it. Sorry, I've gone on a bit.
Thank you very much. In the way of these things, if I can invite questions from the floor, and if I could ask you just to give your name and some context in front of the question, that helps the rest of us as well. And I'll come in with a couple myself in a minute.
It's Martin Simmons. I was heavily involved with the origins of the Thames Gateway, going back to when it was called the East Thames Corridor, circa 1990. The whole emphasis at that time was on economic regeneration. And it's very interesting to hear what you said at the end of your talk. At that time, as you say, we had the Docklands Development Corporation. We also have an enterprise zone in Northwest Kent, which came on the back of the closure of the Chatham Naval Base and the collapse of heavy industry along Kent Tameside. As I say, it's all about economic regeneration and the importance of that for jobs for local communities in the whole of the Gateway. Post the 1997 general election, the emphasis shifted, as you've indicated, very much to housing-led regeneration. And we had both ministers and Ken Livingstone as the Mayor of London seeking to pack as much housing onto the brownfield development opportunities as possible. The economic regeneration imperative was on the back burner, it seemed to me, very much through that period of the Sustainable Communities Plan and so on. What you're advocating now, which I certainly very much welcome, as somebody who's been interested in this throughout the piece, is a focus back on economic development and economic regeneration that you're talking about, the concept of a Thames Gateway economic zone. That's something that I very much welcome. Taking a wide regional view about it, it's always been very much about Thames Gateway seen as bringing round to the east side of London all the investment which has tended to go on the west side. The west side of London, the Thames Valley, seen as becoming potentially overheated. That was the situation in the 1980s. It's certainly the situation now in the 2010s. So getting investment round to the east side of London to create economic development, to create jobs, remains a crucial economic imperative, it seems to me. You know, the big questions, the questions that you've posed, is how we get the government, in fact, to accept that in the national context and to see the east side of London, the Thames Gateway, in the same way as it's seeing the Midlands and North. In terms of the initiatives that we have. Now we have George Osborne's budget just coming up, in which the government is saying that it needs to produce a strategy for growth, a strategy for economic growth. To what extent do you see, in fact, the way forward in terms of convincing the Secretary of State, the government, that it needs to include the east side of London in the same way as it's seeking to rebalance nationally the national economy? In other words, impressing upon the government that it must, in fact, treat this area in a regional context to take pressures off other parts of the South East. Seeing the South East as the motor of the national economy, but the opportunities for development are here rather than in areas that have potential for overheating. So it's a question very much of what steps can you take, in given that we just have a budget coming up which is supposed to be introducing a national economic growth strategy, to focus on this area. I'm sorry to sort of go on in that way, but you know, I'm very much with you on your basic objective here.
Thank you for that. I mean, I think before sort of touching on the second part of that, I just would like to make a bit of a comment on the first. And I think it's, in a sense, I mean, I'm very familiar with the argument that said, oh, well, you know, the new government came into office in 1997 and it was just all about housing. I don't think it ever was just all about housing, actually. And I say that as the person who had to write the Thames Gateway strategic plan at one point. I was certainly very anxious not to make it just about housing. But I think the you know, again, for the benefit of the wider audience, it wasn't entirely accidental. It was because everybody recognised that the demand for housing was accelerating quite fast. And if you looked at where the potential for housing development was, it tended to be in East London, simply because of the availability of land and so on and so on. So in a sense, it wasn't entirely either surprising or an indication of any less interest in economic development, even though it might have been expressed less, to say the government wishes to make commitments about where the housing is going to happen, because housing was an enormously significant political issue, and I think is about to become, again, housing in London will become a very politically significant issue. On the second, what I was doing before I left my office to come here was trying to coordinate the drafting of a letter which I mentioned the Thames Gateway Strategic Partnership, that is the leaders of Kent and Essex, the GLA, it's chaired by Simon Milton, and it has, for each of the sub-regions, it's got four local authority leaders, except in our case it's three because we've got Simon Milton, and it's got private sector representatives as well. And we've put together a letter that they're going to sign, they've all pretty well signed off, and that will go, we hope that will go to the government tomorrow. Now that was set in train at our meeting. The only thing we can do, I think, at this stage is to say, before you make a decision to make an announcement about 10 enterprise zones, one of which is not the Thames Gateway or not the London Thames Gateway, pause and think. What I think will happen is we'll be in exactly the same position we were over the national insurance holiday, which is they'll say an awful lot of stuff. They'll announce 10 enterprise zones, none of which will be in London. They'll say, here are the criteria, and we'll have to we'll be back again on the fighting back. I mean, I didn't say this before, but I think the problem with having decided to designate the whole of London as an enterprise zone is that the London-wide statistics would never justify some of the things that could be argued for if you did it on a sub-regional basis. And I mean, I think all we can do, I mean, certainly my own organisation as a partnership lobbying organisation, all we can do is just keep telling people, keep making the case, keep reminding the government that actually they need this to work. They need this to work because the London economy fuels the rest of the, we're the only tax exporting region. So they've got to make this work. Ideas on a postcard, please. I mean, that's what we're going to do. We'll try and get some visibility for it.
Duncan Mayer, University of Westminster. I just really want to raise a question about where Thames Gateway actually fits within what is left of government strategy. Because the whole concept of Thames Gateway was actually conscious intervention by government to actually steer investment, both in housing and jobs, into a specific geographical area on the basis of the identified opportunities, irrespective to a large extent of the needs of the local area. It was because it had capacity beyond the specific needs of the existing local residents. The current government policy, A, doesn't seem to believe in any national responsibility for actually directing growth in any spatial terms, and B is taking a position that growth areas will only happen where the local residents actually support growth and to a certain extent can self-finance them. So I'm just puzzled as to your basic assumption that government still sees Thames Gateway as a priority for government policy intervention, and also what kind of policy intervention are you expecting in a situation of such severe constraints on public resources, given you've already acknowledged that what little money that's left is going to be directed to the North and the Midlands to deal with what is seen as a more acute collapse of public sector employment?
I think the reason I say, when you say why do I say that the government sees it as a priority, I say that because that's what they say. I'm challenging whether they really mean it, but that is what they say. And I think that it's absolutely the case that we are in a completely different era now, which affects not just the Thames Gateway, but it affects regeneration across the whole of the country. And I suspect that regeneration professionals would tell you that the collapse of public sector activity in very, very challenged parts of the country is absolutely massive. So, I mean, you said, will the government I can't remember your words, but retreating from all this. I mean, it feels to me as if I think we have to make two arguments. One is that in the long run, the UK economy needs the development of the Thames Gateway in the long run, and also that that is both of the benefit to the wider UK economy, but also to residents who are some of the most disadvantaged people in the country. And when you sort of talk about, you know, the impact of public sector job losses outside, there are more people living in poverty in East London than there are in the North East, because of just there are more people. So it's the kind of, on the one hand, the government needs this to work. On the other hand, the scale of challenge in terms of the numbers of people and what has to happen is still enormous. And I think in other times, we've argued that there is a huge social implication of all of this. I mean, I think there are massive social questions about the impact of the housing benefit changes and what that is going to do. I mean, I expect Mr. Travers may have some ideas and thoughts about this. But I mean, that has massive social consequences. And you can't always disentangle social effects from economic effects. So all of my view is we have to continue to say to the government, you say it's a priority. Even if you didn't say it was a priority, we could deduce from a lot of other things you say that it jolly well ought to be a priority. And that's why we want to continue to press you to take policy stances that are supportive of its continued development. That's what I think.
Yes, I wasn't disagreeing with the argument. I was basically saying what was the basis of your belief that government thought it actually mattered.
Well, I'm clearly incredibly naive because, you know, when they write these things, I sort of, you know.
Sorry, I have someone here, but do you want to come back directly on that point, Tony?
Well, only to say that it looks as if the policy towards enterprise zones is indeed, as you say, Ross, going to be driven by an effort to find a short-term, here's something to do, solution to problems of declining employment and public sector employment in potentially very weak market places, whereas there is a separate issue of where an enterprise zone would go if it were trying not only in London, but in London and other places, kindle economies that were nearly ready to go, which might be in East Manchester, but if it's in London, sorry, this is the question I was coming around to, if in London related to that, where would you suggest it would go? If there were one for London, where would you suggest
well,
it would go?
I think that this is a how to do a cop-out, right? This is a cop-out. We don't really know exactly what the government's going to propose yet, so I find that difficult to answer. But my serious point would be that we genuinely don't know exactly what it's going to be. There's an interesting debate, and I'm not an academic, and therefore you are all much better at this than me, as to whether or not, when you do the evaluation of enterprise zones, I've heard it argued both ways that sometimes they were less successful than they might have been because they weren't done at scale. If that were the case, then I'd have said you might want to do it for the whole of East London. But then you might say, well, why the whole of East London and not some bits of West London? Why don't you have the whole of London? Which would never happen because I can't imagine that the government could agree to that or that there would be a case for it. Or do you then say, I sometimes think that the model, this is where it does matter as to what they have in mind. For me, I'd like a model that said you designate a growth area and you might say within that area you have certain criteria that you could apply. So you'd say, I don't know, I was going to say Barking Riverside is if anything going to happen. You'd say, you look at, you have a set of criteria for what's the problem you're trying to solve through a policy measure. You look at which are the places or schemes within the overall geography that might qualify for it, and you apply them. So, I mean, that's... But I think if you were doing that, then how you would... The logic of just doing it in East London and not doing it in West London or North London becomes a lot harder. So I really think I genuinely think it's hard to answer until you know what the proposal is. But one occasion, one rumour is that it's going to be like the whole of Northern Ireland. And you say, well, gosh, if they can do it for the whole of Northern Ireland, then maybe they could be more ambitious. But I think the problem is I can't see the government being able to say, this is all about areas that have been lagging in the past 10 years, oh, and that's London. Just can't see that happening. So if it's got to be something below London, another argument is if you want to create scale, you do it for London and the rest of the Thames Gateway.
Marianne Jane, I'm from a research centre called LCCT here. And my question was, I'm trying to think it through, but I thought it just easier to ask you, which is, what do you think, because you've mentioned that strong leadership is very important, and now you have probably at Hoos, maybe not so. The question is, what do you think maybe the role of the mayor could be for us in terms of, you know, showing strong leadership? I mean, as you said, London is, you know, the economic drive for the UK, and maybe the mayor should have a bigger voice.
I think that's a very good question, and I think also that there is I'll tell you a little sort of not to be passed on story in a second, but I think conceptually, if all the argumentation is about the significance of the Thames Gateway being its proximity to London, the fact is that London does tend to lead. And most of what needs to happen is going to happen in London. So there is quite a strong case for the mayor to do it. And I think, to be fair to Ken, when Ken was the mayor, he was really quite a strong advocate. And if you go back to the sort of the Olympics, and we couldn't have got the Olympics if we hadn't had a pre-existing Thames Gateway programme, Ken's view was always he wasn't interested in a sporting event, he was interested in the regeneration. So I think that is a credible argument. I don't think that the current mayor has been quite such a strong, and he hasn't been so clearly identified with it as a project, although he would always say that he supports it. And if you look at the London plan, it's clearly designated as the sort of, you know, most of the areas of opportunity, much higher proportion, are in the London Thames Gateway, and it is a recognised priority. The difficulty, though, is that sometimes Kent and Essex find it quite sort of irksome that, well, it's all about London. So I have very good relations with my counterparts in Kent and Essex, but I have to manage quite carefully that, you know, we're going to be the carbon sink because we're going to have so much development, but it's nice leafy places like Rain and Marshes and beyond that will be the sort of eco bit that Terry Farrell always talks about. So if you're looking at the whole of the Thames Gateway, you say we all have different parts to play. And that's a great advantage of having a single vision for what the development should be like. But in fact, you know, London, you know, sort of stamps its big feet quite a lot. So it would be interesting to see, I think, post the next mayoral election, whoever is mayor, whether or not that's the opportunity to start reinvigorating this and say, maybe you should make a bid for leadership. And that would be a more powerful position from which to lead.
Nick Banks. So I've been working on Thames Gateway projects probably for the last 35 years, I think. Can I just start with a lesson from the past, slightly waspish one. It seems to me that most of the successful projects, the outturn costs have been an order of magnitude greater than anybody imagined when they agreed the scheme. And I give you a very long list of these. And that they were pushed through by immense momentum from central government. For the future, it seems to me that if you're going to spread the London Docklands bit, which is in many ways the easiest bit, further east, you're going to need huge sums of money. How much money do you want? What would your priorities depend on?
Well, firstly, when I was listening to the first part of what you said, what went through my mind was, and what's so different about the Thames Gateway compared to an awful lot of other...
Limehouse Link was the most expensive road scheme ever. The Millennium Dome at $750 million.
Yeah. And the Olympics.
The transport schemes which aren't supported by the economic
Economic
forever.
Yeah.
85% of our wise investors.
This is the British economy. This is not London.
Well, I mean, my answer to that would be, I do take the point about the scale, but I would not like any people here to think that the Thames Gateway was the only place where there were cost overruns and so on. But I think I would also be quite robust in going back and saying, just remind me how much of the tax take that London delivers to the rest of the economy comes from the places that are very much supported by all that infrastructure. And I don't know, I haven't got the details at my fingertips, but I bet there will be an argument that says the return on that investment more than outweighs, is it sort of the return on the investment over time justifies it, in the sense that no doubt when the project appraisals are done, I don't know what the life that they do and all the rest of it, but it must be the case that now places like Canary Wharf, in terms of the contribution to GDP, have exceeded our best expectations. So is anybody going to... Am I right or wrong about that? Does that sound...
I just don't think you can do that sum. It depends on a whole lot of questions that you don't know the answer to. It also depends on how you attribute effects to causes. So I just don't think that's a sum that you can do.
Well, I think... but equally, I think if you just say, well, that's the most expensive whatever ever built, tunnelling ever built, I kind of think that feels like quite a simplistic way of looking at it, to say, here is the most expensive tunnel per foot or per whatever ever built. Well, actually, that doesn't necessarily mean it wasn't the right thing to do if it is a key part of the connectivity that makes the rest of it work. Okay. There is another point, though, which I probably shouldn't have allowed us to get sidetracked into that, because that was a sort of slightly throwaway remark. I don't think anybody thinks that the future vision of the Thames Gateway is let's just build Canary Wharf out and out and out. I think that it's publicly available, there is a sort of a narrative story by Terry Farrell on what he thinks about the future development of the Gateway. And it is very much not just building Canary Wharf further and further east. So I don't think what you're saying is either what would happen or what is in prospect or in any way wanted.
So how much do you want and what would you spend it on?
Well, speaking in person. I think I can't answer that. There is a lot of building to be done. There is a lot of potential. We recognise very clearly it's going to have to come from various sources, including and largely private finance. I don't think there is a number that you can put, because I'd answer that by saying, well, if you gave me this amount, we could do this much. If you gave me that amount, you know, because in a sense, a presupposition here is this is all about building and development, I'd say, what about how much money you could put into relaxing caps on university places so you could actually take in more students and change, you know, a lot of the local students who live in the Gateway and go to Gateway FE colleges and universities are now not going to be able to go. You could say, how much money would it take to give EMAs back, so that, you know, 90% of the kids at Newham College could carry on there instead of having to go. So it's not a straightforward question, because it's, is it for capital, is it for revenue support, is it for business support? You know, I'm sure we could spend as much as anybody with their kindness could push our way.
If I could ask, just because you've had your names, the money and the control as your sort of three elements, and as we've sort of partly talked about names and just talked about money, I wonder if I could ask you about the control. So in those terms, just maybe to ask how much control you'd want, or what perhaps changes in the sort of regulations you'd like to see in order to push that one.
I think it's the model in the past was very much about top-down central government control. You know, development corporations were answerable directly to ministers. The London Thames Gateway Development Corporation answerable directly to ministers. There are now going to be, I should answer this in a slightly different way. I think there's no point in saying what I'd like, as compared to, well, what are we going to get? And I think some of the things we might be going to get through the localism bill and through the sections on London in terms of devolution to the mayor may well put in place the kinds of organisations, and I'm thinking of the Olympic Park Legacy Corporation, that may well have the sorts of controls that you might think were the right things to have in place to push that project forward. However, I think there are a lot of other changes coming through in terms of changes to the planning framework and various other things coming through the localism bill that I think are going to be very interesting to see what effect they have. Most of them seem to be taking control away and putting responsibility in certain places without necessarily putting control in those places. So, you know, where I live in Lambeth, and, you know, going to meetings where the council say, you know, take libraries as an example. Oh, let's give local people the responsibility for the library. Oh, that sounds really good. Well, they may be given responsibility. Whether or not they're given control is another question. And where there is, where the sort of accountability for having given that responsibility remains is yet another question. So we're moving into a world that, again, I think it's quite hard to see how all this will play out. In the one very, very obvious development area in the Thames Gateway, there will be a development corporation answerable to the mayor, but nevertheless with quite considerable planning powers, assuming all the legislation all goes through. And who knows, maybe that will work. But for the rest, I think the picture is still incredibly complex, would be my view.
Martin Goldston, another member of the Legs Club up the front here, but one of the things that a reflection that what you said provoked really was, I mean, I worked for the Heseltine Ministry on the East Thames Corridor, the first piece of strategic work for the East Thames Corridor, and again for the legendary MISC 22 committee that I was delighted to hear you mention, when Prescott was
right about how it
And in both cases, the argument we were putting was, put this heavy-duty kit in and development will cluster around it. Now, that was the core argument of both the original East Thames Corridor report, and it was also about how, in this case, the sort of nodes along the fast rail line could work. And I think what you were saying was, in relation to the enterprise zone, you were saying it sort of depends what the problem is you're trying to solve. And I think that's what I think is most interesting in what you've been saying. What's the problem you're trying to solve now? You've got all this stuff, you invested a huge amount actually. How can we now capture and harness the use of that investment? Which is why I quite like the sorts of, if you like, soft measures type of stuff you're talking about. Because it seems to me that that's really where we ought to be going, is not necessarily hankering after an extension of the big ticket stuff, but it's what are the ways in which you can get leverage from what has actually been a major piece of national investment over the last 25 years?
I think, I mean, again, these, you know, one could spend ages on this. I think that the reason I said it depends on what you're trying to do is partly because when we put forward our ideas, we said, there seems to be, you could sort of have a wider category, which is measures to support enterprise growth, right? And I don't think there is a single measure. Some of them could be putting a bit of money in, least likely now. Some of them could be things like the national insurance holiday, you would argue, was a measure to support enterprise growth. You could say relaxation in the planning system. There's a range of different things you can do. And you might want to do different things in different places. And when it comes to what is the problem that you're trying to solve, there's a bit of me that says, I think one of the biggest challenges we face is tackling economic need in the existing resident population in the Gateway.
Yeah.
Because if you don't do that, then it's sort of one of the things where I think the government has been quite bold in thinking about welfare reform and saying it is not sustainable to leave people like this for any length of time. So if it was, if I might say, I would like to see measures that would provide that sort of support. That isn't necessarily enterprise support, unless you can say, well, it sort of is really, because some of the measures you might want to do is you might want to make it easier for people to start up businesses or something like that. And you might then say, if, I mean, I was giving you some statistics about the you know, relative age of the workforce, they're young, they're quite entrepreneurial. If we've got a young entrepreneurial workforce, one of the enterprise measures might be, well, what is it you can do to make it easier for them to start up businesses and get business support to keep them going? Now, I don't know that that is anything other than just bog standard economic development that we haven't been doing as well as we might have been able to. But whether or not that's the sort of measure we need to be looking at now, and encouraging people to come in and assist that process. I went to a great thing the other night, which was the opening of a place called, next to Tech Hub. It was another of these sort of Start Hub, I think it was called. And it was basically, it was in Hackney, in the, you know, golden, you know, silicon corridor from Old Street to Stratford. Start Hub it was called, I think. And essentially, it was managed office space for young entrepreneurs who wanted to do digital, you know, very nice young man who wants to make apps and that kind of thing. And it was sort of managed business space, lots of business support on tap. That's the kind of thing. Can we make it a lot easier for people to do that? Either because you make it easier for them to get the space, because you know there's a great initiative in Newham which is called Meanwhile Space. And what this is about is saying there's loads of bits of undeveloped land that are just sitting around waiting for the upturn. They'll be waiting for years, and in the meantime they're awful. And the concept of Meanwhile Space is let out, you know, very short leases for a year. You're a young entrepreneur, go and live there for a year next to nothing, and maybe you'll be able to start your business. And there's that kind of thing. So I think it's much, much too difficult a question to answer in a short space of time. But the basic thing is identify the problem that you're trying to solve. Think of the measures that you might need to put in place, and then say, encapsulate that in a big ask that allows for all of that. That would be my view.
Thank you.